Beyond what we can understand with our rational minds, our bodies have an innate, natural sense of wisdom and truth. We can deeply feel authenticity in ourselves and in others, and as we slowly learn to trust this bodily wisdom, we settle deeply and peacefully into ourselves. Whilst this felt sense of reality and capacity to access our deep inner truth is richly spoken of in Eastern spiritual traditions, almost nothing has been written about it in contemporary psychology and neuroscience. That's where Dr. John Prendergast, one of the foremost experts in somatic healing and psychotherapy, has bridged the latest findings in science and psychology with spirituality to present an enriched compass of our inner senses. In his book, In Touch, John peers deeply into this deeper dimension of felt wisdom that we all have access to. At the heart of his work is the message that our body is an exquisitely sensitive feeling instrument, and as we learn to tune into its subtle signals, the gifts of greater clarity, healing, and inner knowing await us. I caught up with John to learn more about the wisdom of our body and how we can get more in touch with ourselves and our deepest sense of inner truth. Oh, we can think of our sense-making faculties as both thinking and sort of cognitive capability and this deeper felt sense of reality, which is the subject of what we're talking about today. And I really feel like that felt sense of reality is very richly kind of addressed in the longer sort of spiritual wisdom traditions, and we're sort of playing catch up in psychology and neuroscience. And one of the things I loved in your book is you start to lay out where the findings have got to there. So I was wondering perhaps if we could start with, if you could give, you know, a brief sense of what the sort of scientific and psychological community think of, you know, our felt sensing capabilities, in particular, you know, the subject matters of about limbic resonance and attachment theory and mirror neurons, which you spoke about in your book.
That's such a broad subject, but I'll take a stab at it. I must say I'm not like a specialist in this area. My area of interest has really been more subjective and working one-on-one. But when I wrote the book, In Touch, it felt important to make a link with what's emerging in terms of this science of attunement, which I devoted quite a bit of time of looking into and educating myself about. So I'm really, in a way, a kind of lay, you know, not an expert, but kind of an interested lay person in looking at this interface that you're pointing to. And it was very interesting to discover just how the field has grown. And Daniel Siegel, who's a psychiatrist and works at UCLA and is well known for his work in mindfulness, has been one of the pioneer researchers in this field and just finding links between objective indicators of connection and subjective experiences. And so this is just fascinating to me to see that there are scientists and researchers such as Siegel who are making these links. And also, it's been really interesting to me to see how the whole field of understanding empathy has changed over the years, because when I was a grad student 35 years ago, there was a very different theory of empathy. You know, it was more thought to be a function of imagination. We hear someone describe their experience, and then we try to imagine what that was like, and we compare it to some experience we've had on our own. But in fact, you know, what we discovered in almost by accident in the mid-1990s are these mirror neurons, this particular motor neurons, and this is a discovery by a group of Italian scientists in monkeys, that we have this ability to track, you know, actually the intention and the feeling and sensations of other people through these remarkable mirror neurons. So we actually simulate the experience internally as we observe that behavior being done in another person. And so we get a taste, a very, very direct taste of the other person's experience. So this is the discovery of mirror neurons has been a really important one. And also our understanding of limbic, you know, as mammalians, and you know, we share this triune brain, and there's a reptilian brain and a so-called, you know, monkey brain and human brain, and we have this limbic system that is affected on an emotional level, and so through mirror neurons and the limbic system, we can very faithfully and accurately, attune with one another. And so this, we're not as isolated as we think. And there's this whole field of intersubjectivity that's emergent, both in psychology and neuroscience, where we realize we're much more connected and interconnected than we ever realized. And there are physiological mechanisms that, in part, reflect that. Now, what's interesting to me also is that I don't think this is the complete, the complete answer as to why we're able to attune with one another. I think there are subtler dimensions, and these are often have been addressed in more meditative traditions, that as the body and the mind get quieter, a different kind of sensitivity comes online, a surprising one. And this is, you know, this is really the subject of my book, the sense of inner knowing, which Eugene Genlon and Carl Rogers really uncovered in the 1960s. And Genlon went on to describe as the felt sense and felt sensing that you were referring to in your short introduction. So it's fascinating just to see that, you know, we have this, it needs to be developed. We have this capacity to have a whole body sense of a situation or of a relationship or of an experience or even of an inner knowing that corresponds with what physiologists call interoception, the ability to experience subtle internal signals, physiological and subtle signals as well. So the overlap is very interesting and unfolding. And it gives, I think, for me, the value of it is it allows us to realize and validate that we do have this capacity for inner knowing. And if we pay attention, it begins to come more into the forefront of our awareness.
What's interesting, I think, is as we start to withdraw a bit from perhaps our cognitive faculties and start to feel a bit more into our sense of reality, I think one of the early cornerstones of that is this idea of resonance, right? Which is a subject you touched upon earlier in your book. This is almost, you know, the jumping point, if you like, into almost out of the science, if you like, and into the real conscious kind of aspect of this. And I wonder perhaps if you could describe, what do you think resonance, what does resonance mean to you, and how do we, you know, detect the early signs of that?
Well, I like Daniel Siegel's definition, which is resonance is really mutual attunement. And so we begin with attunement and our ability to attune with intrapersonally, that is to say, with our interior experience, our ability to sense our body, not just the externals, but the interior, and not just, say, you know, breathing or heartbeat, but a whole field of sensation in the interior of the body. And so as we begin to pay attention to that, we're actually more in touch with, for instance, our feelings. And, a global sense of what's going on in our interior. As we are more attuned to our interior experience, we're able to actually be more attuned to other people as well. You know, if we're in touch with our feelings, for instance, if we're in touch with anger or sadness or, you know, grief or shame, if we know the inner feeling of that, then we can recognize and relate to that in others. And so when that's happening mutually between two people, when there's mutual attunement, there is this phenomena of resonance. We're on the same wavelength. That's what resonance means. We're on the same wavelength. And that can happen in different ways. It can happen intellectually when there's an understanding of a particular concept or idea that's or method of inquiry that's unfolding. It can happen on an emotional level where, you know, we're with someone who's sad and we get a feeling of that sadness and we can share in that in a compassionate way, or we sense that someone is angry, not just, you know, we see it on their face or hear it in their voice, but we can actually get an internal feel for that as well. So that would be cognitive, that would be emotional. And there are subtler dimensions of this mutual attunement or resonance, which are more energetic as well. And so It's interesting when I work with people, this is something I should back up a little bit. You know, I've been interested in a deep inquiry into the nature of, you know, into true nature, I would say, for, you know, since my late teens, and meditated and did a lot of interior work. And at some point, this whole kind of level of sensitivity began to unfold. This is almost 40 years ago, and has just gradually increased. And so what I found when I worked with people is this ability to attune with accurately and resonate with another person's internal experience. And that allowed me to track feelings sometimes before people were actually aware of it themselves. I would feel a kind of sadness in the room, or I would feel it in the heart area, you know, in the center of the chest, when I was in my own chest sitting with someone. And a minute or two later, they would start talking about grief or loss. And I realized, oh, I'm actually attuning with someone else's experience. And that's just developed over the years. And what's interesting about this for me is that not only can we attune cognitively and emotionally and energetically, we can attune with the ground of being. There's a shared sense of profound loving awareness that's really at the core of each of us. And as that's unfolded in my own awareness, I can often, not always, sense that unfolding in another person and help them be aware of it as well.
Mm. There's an interesting, I think, very insightful point you make in the book about when we first start to cultivate this resonance and perhaps get more into touch with our intuition. There's a potential for hazard, I guess, in terms of the discernment that we have about following those. Because you said a very interesting point that our intuition can actually be misled perhaps by fear or desire or rooted in those, particularly if we're being goal oriented. And I suspect that the right advice is to, you know, test that out, test your intuition out and do that step by step. I wonder what your reflections were on that.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because even though this is a capacity that we have, you know, a subtle sensing and intuiting, there are just so many other factors that can distort it. And we can be projecting, you know, what we are afraid someone is experiencing or what we want someone to experience. There's fear and desire. Mm-hmm. And that really obscures the much subtler signal of our inner knowing, you know, and this is just so human for us to do that. So I'm in complete accord with you. I think it's really important, particularly when we're beginning to discover this, to test it out. Not act on it as if it's true, but, you know, check it out, take notes, you know, because we do have a confirmation bias. We like to find evidence for what we think is true and discard that which is not. So it's really honesty and integrity are really the ability to really be rigorously honest with one's own experience and stay in integrity with that is and keep examining and looking at ways that we filter and distort our own perception, I think, is extremely important. And that's part of psychological and spiritual maturity as well.
Yeah, it feels like it's definitely an art balancing those two. You made another great point I thought about. There's a ease, particularly in a lot of new age approaches, to sort of hijack the intuited wisdom in the body and sort of merge that with your goal, for example, and sort of push forward. And that's something that goes unnoticed, I think, perhaps for a lot of people until they fall into it and then get confused by, you know, sandwiching their mind's idea over their sort of feelings in what was, you know, in a kind of good intended way, but it doesn't tend to work out well.
Yeah, it's true. You see it in a lot of new age approaches where, you know, there's an emphasis on trusting your intuition and your inner knowing. You know, but in service to what? You know, usually their desire, you know, there's a desire basically to manipulate that function in order to, you know, improve on circumstances. And, you know, that again, a very human and understandable tendency, but one that's really important to look at. Because what I found with this inner knowing and this kind of subtle sensing is that it's not assertive at all. It doesn't really have you know, a goal in mind, other than, I think, well-being, overall well-being. And it speaks in a very, you know, in a very quiet and sometimes subtle way. So not necessarily, you know, in words. It could come as a sensation or as an image, and we may need to sit with that a while before its meaning unfolds. So it's not, it doesn't function in that kind of goal-oriented linear way, and it's certainly not assertive, and sometimes, you know, reveals things to us that are really difficult and challenging in terms of our view of ourself and the world.
Here today with a psychologist and somatic healer, Dr. John Prendergast. If you're enjoying today's episode, you can learn more about our guest as well as read show notes from the episode at innertruth.org/touch. I'm David Newell, and this is Inner Truth. Yeah, there was a very interesting point. You sort of said that, you know, as we journey from the head to the heart and cultivate this felt sense, that a lot of the wisdom, intelligence that starts to come up from the body might actually be taking you away from what would be seen as sort of traditional measures of success, you know, money or fame, and actually pushing you into an entirely different track. And instead of being rewarded with those traditional measures, you're actually rewarded with something much deeper. And that's the sort of inner coherence and inner congruence of being, you know, in track with your inner knowing.
That's it. And it's interesting, as you say that, David, I could feel that in you. I can feel that, you know, you're following that in yourself. And, you know, and so we discard, you know, we discard the more conventional markers of success and happiness. And we start following something much deeper, which involves much more letting go, you know, letting go of ideas and stories and you know, many conventional standards and values. So it actually takes a lot of courage, I think, to follow this. I know at many points in my life, I took, you know, the road less traveled. I, you know, entered the less well-known school. I chose a partner who was, you know, clearly not physically well. But there was, you know, there was a clear guidance to do that. And I'm so glad that I did. You know, it's just, it's turning one's kind of surrendering the conventional mind to a much deeper wisdom, and you know, I'm deeply grateful to have access to that and to listen to it and to have followed it.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think, you know, the very sort of heart of this book, I think, is that, you know, the body is an exquisitely sensitive instrument once you get into the subtler aspects of it. And there's, you know, there's a lot of different traditions that have highlighted its different sort of faculties, let's say. I think in the book, obviously, we talk about it using the chakra system, and I wondered if we could perhaps give a quick overview of that and then maybe drop into one or two of those centers, just to give people a sense of what those deeper and subtler embodied wisdom centers are.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, this is something, this has been a kind of unfolding realization on my part. I had read about the chakras before experiencing them, but my experience unfolded just during long meditation courses, you know, beginning in my mid-20s or so, and beginning with the center that's between and above, slightly above the eyebrows, the so-called sixth chakra, and then gradually others began to emerge in awareness. But there are, in my experience, there are seven major energy centers, and these have been described in both yogic, Indian yogic, and Tibetan yogic traditions. The first is at the base of the spine, and is involved with survival issues. So when people feel like their survival is being threatened, there's a subtle but very palpable kind of clenching at the base of the spine. And energy shuts off. We feel ungrounded. It's difficult to feel the ground. Our legs may feel shaky. We have a sense of the rug being pulled out from under us. And conversely, when that center is open, we feel very grounded, very much at ease in our body. And so what's interesting is around the root chakra it can contract when we face danger or even the thought of danger. And the thought of danger can be on a physical level, but also a psychological level, the fear of losing oneself. And so therefore, in early developmental levels of experience, when we have parenting where that's either very neglectful or abusive or very engulfing, there's a sense of, you know, annihilation that's there, and it's very threatening to the system, and it has an impact on that level. I mention that because it often comes up in my work with people, that kind of feeling of terror is associated with that. The interesting thing is working with a particular center like that is that if you really lean into it, if you have enough resources and support and lean into it, you'll discover the opposite. So if you go into that terror or that shakiness, you'll find actually a deep peace and stability. But that takes a lot of courage. Anyway, that's the first chakra. Second chakra is a few inches above that in the lower belly and is involved with sensuality and sexuality. The third chakra is in the solar plexus area. It has to do with interpersonal power and control. This is really an important area of emotional control. And I find often working with people that, particularly when they're deep in the spiritual search, there is this kind of dilemma of needing to let go of the ordinary way of thinking about things. And our knowing, our ordinary and conventional knowing, is a lot about trying to control. And so turning that over, often the solar plexus is also involved. The third chakra, fourth chakra is the heart area. Kind of midway in the energy system. And this, you know, the heart is all about love and compassion and gratitude, appreciation, intimacy, and just fullness of life.
I think the heart center is particularly interesting. I just want to stop there and focus on it because you very sort of eloquently describe its kind of multifaceted nature, I think, and those three parts you sort of suggested, the ego, the soul, and the self components. And I think they can really create some difficult dynamics for people, particularly in relationships and so forth. And there's a very beautiful line you put about, you know, when we become hurt and because we're confused, to protect ourselves, we bury the treasure of our sensitivity, and reclaiming it then becomes this sort of long thawing out process. And what do you
Exactly that. Yeah. I mean, the heart area is so central, you know, it's so centrally located in the body, kind of in the center. But it's also the center of our relational life, relating to other people and relating to life as a whole, and coming into an accepting and relation and loving relationship to oneself. So it's this is actually the subject of my next book that I'm working on for Sounds True, is the heart, because it's so, so important and so sensitive. So early on when we're kids, you know, we're just very sensitive to the emotional and energetic environment that we're raised in, and particularly, you know, with our primary caretakers, usually our parents. And so, you know, if we feel unseen, if we feel seen in a highly distorted way, unloving and unaccepted way, if we are, you know, criticized and judged, the heart area begins to close down, and we often are unaware of it. It's just something that happens kind of instinctively and unconsciously, but it's not unusual. But by the time, if we go through a, you know, relationally difficult childhood, our hearts become pretty closed and pretty numb. And that's what we carry into our relationships as adolescence and adulthood. And these are psychologists refer them to it as attachment styles. A certain template is set in terms of our openness or defendedness in relationship, and results in all sorts of complex relational dynamics as well. And so the work, you know, the work that takes tremendous courage, that comes from the French word cœur, you know, meaning the heart, is to begin to open our hearts and risk, you know, what we, you know, being hurt, being abandoned, loss, in order to love, right? And so this is sort of the, you mentioned the three levels that I often talk about with the heart, the egoic and soulful and big S self or no self. And the egoic level goes very, very deeply. It's kind of like, you know, an archaeological dig. That's another metaphor that I use often. When we begin to explore the heart, we encounter younger and younger layers of it developmentally, kind of strata, if you will, and encounter reasons why we closed our hearts in the first place. And then we update. This is the good news. You know? The bad news is we close our hearts. The good news is we're able to open them again. And we can bring in, you know, our mature adult understanding, because as children, you know, we don't really understand what's going on. We don't have that perspective that our parents may be suffering and battling their own inner demons. And if we're treated badly, it doesn't mean we're bad, you know. In other words, it's not about us. And that's such an important realization in the work. We internalize, we interpret our experience in very simple and powerful ways, and then they become an identity, and then we defend against them. So in other words, you know, we often feel like something's wrong with us. You know, we're unlovable. We're not acceptable as we are. Part of that is our childhood conditioning. And as adults, we can begin to step back and open to our feelings and examine our core beliefs and see that they're really distorted, and then we can update them. Kind of update our old programming and have a much more accurate and kinder sense of self. All that's on the level of ego, and it's very useful preliminary work, and maybe not even preliminary, deep work. And it inevitably will arise when we're going deep into a process of spiritual inquiry.
Mm. Yeah, I think, I mean, we've touched upon a huge piece of work there, and it's addressed, you know, deeply in the book, this idea of limiting beliefs that we, you know, unconsciously and consciously pick up through childhood and perhaps later that translate into this chronic inattention that, you know, we can be carrying around for years before we start to stop and just wonder why we have this, you know, underlying tension, another physical malaise in the body. And there's some very interesting ways in which you work with clients, I think, to help find them. I wondered if perhaps you could talk through some examples of how you work with that.
Yeah, it's an important piece of my work. And I find, you know, when I do retreats and workshops, I always include this. And it's almost always very kind of revelatory and liberating for people to explore in this way. So that's right. We form... very early on, we form a view of ourself and the world called a self-world view by existential psychologists. And we have a kind of core identity. And it's made up of these usually, you know, a series, not a large series, of core limiting beliefs, or call it negative beliefs, negative because they're limiting in terms of our sense of self. So, what I found is they tend to constellate around two major themes. And one is there's a sense of lack, something's missing, I'm not enough. And that's how the belief is. I'm not smart enough. I'm not good looking enough. I'm not interesting enough, whatever it may be, whatever the X is in that formulation, I'm not X enough. And the other is that something's wrong with me. I'm flawed. So lack and flaw, these are the kind of two major poles, and sometimes both. You know, poles, P-O-L-E-S, around which our core beliefs constellate. So they do form in childhood. They're often subconscious or semi-conscious. And they, to a large extent, run our emotional life, and particularly in relationships. So it's very important to be aware of them. And there are different ways to do so. The recognition of them is the first major step. And the simplest way to do that, and for your listeners, I would encourage them to, you know, give this a try, is to just sit down and write a list of what they think's wrong with them or what's lacking. And find a few phrases, make it very simple, a few simple phrases that really have a charge, and kind of narrow it down to a couple of them and pick the one that feels most important or most charged. And just notice when you have the thought, what is the effect in the body and on a feeling level? And what you'll notice is that there'll be some kind of contraction on a somatic level, some tightening or tension, you know, the kind that you referred to. And emotionally, there'll be some kind of reaction, maybe an emotional feeling of shame or fear or rage or guilt, things of that sort. So you just test it out. And this is so interesting that these thoughts are so powerful. Just to discover that is a major major discovery. And then the next step is to begin to question them. And there are a lot of techniques and methods to do this. You could do it rationally, just ask if that's a rational thought, and that can take the edge off of it. But because these are not particularly rational thoughts, and because they are formed by, you know, basically by our young child selves, even if we rationally can discount them, they still have power and continue to run. So we need to approach them on a different level. And I've worked with this for decades with people and developed a very simple process that I do lay out in one of the chapters of my book that you're familiar with, David. And that's to bring attention into the heart area once you've recognized what the belief is. So let's say the belief is, you know, I'm unlovable. So you bring your attention to the heart area and then ask yourself, what's my deepest knowing about this? And then be quiet. Don't go to your mind for an answer. You know, we're not interested so much on a cognitive response. We're actually tapping into heart wisdom, this deeper way of knowing. So, you know, something's wrong with me. I'm lacking something important, some basic lack or flaw. What's my deepest knowing about this? And just sitting for like a minute or two quietly and noticing what comes. This is a very important step here. Step two. Step one is to recognize it. Step two is to inquire from heart wisdom. And there's a quiet inner knowing that we're accessing, we're entering into dialogue with. And this allows a very spontaneous, subtle and spontaneous reprogramming to happen. Or learning, we could say. And something will start to emerge, and we may feel it in the heart area or as a sensation, as a feeling, an image may arise, or there may be a simple word that comes up or a simple sentence such as, oh, I know that's not true, or that's not even relevant. So when that comes, this is a very delicate moment. It's really, next step is to let it in, really let in this other knowing. And what's happening is you're letting the light of awareness begin to saturate, permeate, penetrate the old conditioning in the body mind. And that's happening in the brain and the nervous system, in the cells, in the body. We're letting in the light of awareness, the light of heart wisdom, to put it very simply, and it begins to transform. There's a transmutational process or transformative process that begins, and the old programming begins to lose its compelling nature, and something much deeper begins to infuse the body mind. So we let it in, and that could be, sometimes I'll ask people, just breathe it in, you know, just let in this knowing and feel the impact of that. So a few breaths and just sensing, allowing this in. And that's pretty much it. And then, you know, it doesn't change. Occasionally it'll change dramatically, but usually it's a process. It's something that we have to revisit over, you know, a series of quiet inner meditations. And then we begin to get a sense of, you know, really some other principle beginning to work. That, and this is what's very interesting, that's very loving and very clear. And these qualities of love or, you know, compassion or kindness and the quality of clarity or wisdom, these are facets of our true nature. And what we're doing is we're tapping into those and opening to them to help transform our inner experience of ourself. And what happens is those beliefs, those sense of lack or flaw, gradually begin to lose their charge. They're just not believable, even on a subconscious level. And we open up. That's the beauty of it. It's like this deeper aspect of self, the deeper qualities of the heart, these qualities of clarity and kindness, of wisdom and love, begin to actually radiate. And it's so beautiful. You can hear the kind of the enthusiasm in my voice. When I sit with someone and I can feel this process happening, it is so, it's like a miracle. I mean, I'm so delighted. And interestingly, people do light up. They report lighting up. There's like this quality of radiance that begins to shine from, you know, deep within their hearts or their bellies and radiate out. And, you know, their eyes brighten, they smile. You know, you can just, there's a whole lightness of being that begins to emerge. And it's very touching and very beautiful. And it's validating. So when it happens, you know, I say, notice what's happening. This is how your body is responding to the truth. You know, the body's response to untruth or to a lie is contraction. And the body's response to the truth or our true nature is openness, radiance, because that is our true nature, and it's the true nature of the body as well.
No, it is beautiful. I think these wounds and these limiting beliefs become portals to discovery, as you exactly. Sit up there and you find greater embodied lightness afterwards. I thought one of the really touching and powerful stories in the book was the client you had who was feeling into a space and started to receive this image, I think, of a chasm, and he just couldn't imagine crossing it. And it really brought to mind, just in that exercise you were just talking there, about how we create images and stories, you know, at an unconscious or sort of semi-conscious level about something. And your advice to him in that moment was powerful, which was just, you know, become the chasm. And as he did, he melted through it into an entirely different experience and essentially passed through that. And yeah, that's an interesting realization, I think, because many people sort of maybe stop at the, you know, the chasm image in their mind.
That's it, you know, and the mind really abhors emptiness. It just really likes to know what's going on. And, you know, it likes to, you know, fill itself with ideas and subtle mental objects. So when it encounters emptiness, it projects onto it everything that it fears the most. And this is another fascinating thing that's unfolded in my, you know, deep work with people, is to see that encounter with emptiness and that mechanism of projection. So the emptiness can look, you know, like it's completely devoid of any relationship or any contact or any warmth. In other words, it's an abandoning space, or it can be a devouring space, you know, as well. But it's neither of those, you know, it's mysterious, that's all. So the invitation really, it's kind of for the mind to take a leap off the cliff inwardly and actually be that empty, apparently empty space. So it's opening into the unknown. It's opening out of our conventional sense of identity, of who we are as a limited being, really into the unknown and what is infinite. And this is really a leap into freedom and a leap into our true nature. So what we discover when there is that willingness, either we slip into it or fall into it or dive into it, is that it's not what we think it is. And we discover. You know, we discover a completely different dimension of life and being, and it's a delight when that happens.
You can find more episodes as well as show notes from today on our website at innertruth.org. You can also join the community on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm David Newell, and this is Inner Truth.
Yeah, we touched upon it just then, which is, you know, in this, it's a lifetime's cultivation, this journey from the head into the heart. And in this thawing out process, you know, you were talking about the four major somatic markers in the body, that kind of sense of relaxed groundedness and inner alignment and open-heartedness and spaciousness as we're moving on. I think the first one there's is really interesting, that kind of core contraction and inner grip of fear that we all sort of have to begin with until we start to do this work and find an inherent grounding in reality. And yeah, I wondered how you see that play out and manifest in people. Is that the beginning of the journey, is letting go of that particular piece and finding the groundedness?
Well, not necessarily. Actually, often that's the last one. Because it's sort of the last stronghold of the grip, you know, or survival instinct. But what I find are, there's no particular rule here about how this unfolds. Maybe as I say that, probably, you know, of those four portals, you know, kind of the sense of spaciousness is often the most easily accessible. And that's when the mind gets quiet and we feel there's a silence and sense of, you know, we can't really feel the boundary of where we end and where the apparent world begins. So, you know, I guess spaciousness is maybe fairly accessible, particularly in meditative states. But that letting go of, you know, that kind of inner grip, particularly in the lower part of the torso, that kind of knot, almost an existential grip trying to hold on to, you know, being limited, is very profound. And often we're not even aware that it's there until we're well into the unfolding process. And because we take, it's such a, this is a, actually another book I want to write when I'm done with the heart, which has to do with the ground. It's just so fascinating that we construct a false ground. And I analogize it to kind of a layer of ice, you know, above a pond or a lake. It's frozen. And it has an apparent solidity, but it's actually fairly thin. And that ground is, you know, a belief that things don't change, and that who I am is, I know who I am. And yet we find, of course, that that's not true at all, that everything is changing moment to moment, less dramatically, although occasionally it does. But over time, you know, all the forms, all the waveforms are arising and subsiding and coming and going, you know, what in Buddhism is called impermanence. And, you know, we try to deny that. We try to adjust to that and adapt to it. But that's much like standing on frozen ground and a limited set of beliefs. So when we give up, you know, start to deeply question who we think and feel that we are, our constructed ground, our conventional ground, begins to thaw or shake or break open. And it can feel very destabilizing. I mean, if you've ever had a certain view of life in yourself that you've taken to be true and then you realize isn't, it's temporarily very disorienting. It's ungrounding. So this is one of the interesting things, is that in this quest to know who we are fundamentally, we do go through a period of giving up a kind of conventional solidity, and we may go through a period of some disorientation or ungroundedness before a different ground begins to emerge. And that ground is not concrete, it's not objective, it's actually a deep subjectivity. It's realizing that awareness itself is our ground and is the source and substance of everything. So as that realization unfolds, it's like an, oh my God, you know, this, it's sometimes referred to as a groundless ground because it's non-material, it's non-objective, and yet it's palpably felt to be true. And one of the fascinating things about the ground and our sense of the ground is the truth is grounding, ultimately. It can be temporarily ungrounding if we're attached to a lie or living a lie. But ultimately, it's deeply grounding. And so our body responds to this deepening, ultimately to this deepening exploration of who we really are, by feeling more and more grounded and more at ease. And so we have the experience, and this is where language becomes very both metaphoric and often paradoxical, is that we feel deeply here and very much in our body, but we're not limited to our body. So it's like the body is vibrant and alive and there's no dissociation. But there's also not an identification, a exclusive identification with the body. So the body feels very expansive, very fluid, very light. It's interesting. So our whole sense of ground changes as we go deeply in this exploration.
No, it's one of the pieces that I really deeply resonated with. I think it really reminded me of Adi Ashanti's book, The End of Your World, because it really helped. And yours, I think, actually went a lot deeper on this, because it can be terribly confusing when you get into that self-inquiry process, whether that's been, you know, launched by yourself or by something that's happened in your life, a major, and, you know, you can move into all sorts of disassociated states or different sort of approaches. And if you're sort of unaware that they are, you know, natural states and temporary and moving around, then you can make things a lot worse, right?
That's right. This is where normalizing is really helpful, and being able to work with, to read about it or work with someone who understands this territory, then you can relax more around it. And that allows the passage to be a lot easier. You know, you mentioned Adi Ashanti, and Adi was one of my main teachers. He's a friend now. And we've had conversations exactly on this point of the ground. He doesn't, you know, in his writings, he doesn't go as much specificity of it, but he's extremely familiar with exactly what we're talking about. And certainly his students encounter this as people who I work with do as well.
Mm. I wanted to move on to, I guess, another quality of truth as we embody it. And I think we spoke about it in terms of, or you did it in terms of alignment, and that very beautiful Adi Ashanti quote that you put in, that the truth always brings everything into alignment. There's an interesting verticality that comes into the body, right? I think as we get more in touch with our inner knowing. How have you observed that?
Uh-huh. Well, exactly that, you know, and I mean, you're hitting all the all the central points, and which is a delight. I can feel that you're also experiencing them to some degree. So I'm just enjoying that as we talk about this. But yeah, this is one of the interesting things, is that when people get in touch with their truth, and this can be a relative truth about just, you know, what their experience is, it may be their emotional experience or some intellectual clarity, there is a sense of alignment that happens internally, things lining up. And I think your listeners, at least some of them, will be able to relate to this sense of inner alignment. And interestingly, physically, I find when I'm working with people and they start getting in touch with their truth on whatever level, relative or ultimate, they actually start sitting upright more. You know, they may be leaning a little to the left or the right, or hunching over forward, or slouching back, and they just, without thinking about it, you know, they begin to aright themselves. And so there is this sense of verticality, and it's as if there's a vertical line that runs along the spine that goes deep into the ground, we could say, that goes below and goes above, extends far above. And so we can feel this sense of alignment, and it corresponds with a sense of essential aliveness too. Alignment, aliveness, they're very closely related essential qualities. And of course, it does correspond to the yogic teachings of the central channel that you'll find in both Tibet and Indian yogic traditions, referred to as kundalini sometimes. But there is a life energy that flows through all beings, certainly all human beings, in my experience, that is generally dormant. And as we open to essential, who we are, essentially, this tends to activate. And we feel ourselves more in flow, a sense of flow, a sense of deep aliveness, a sense of inner alignment that has very little to do with our outer circumstances. Right? Normally, we're very reliant on our circumstances to feel a sense of aliveness, you know, to be stimulated. But this is really from, it feels like, in the very core of our being. And so it's like the body is lighting up. This is the beauty, you know, of this process of awakening. You know, the mind awakens and we realize that we're not our thoughts and not our stories. And the heart awakens and we feel this just joy and sense of fullness and gratitude and seamless connection with all of life. And the interior, the very core of the body, lights up as well. And there's this sense of aliveness and alignment. And as the body, this is kind of another very interesting point, as this awakening process deepens in the body and there's this illumination in the core or the interior, we feel more and more intimate with the whole of life. It's as if the world lights up and becomes more vibrant too. So this has been interesting in my experience because it, you know, this kind of vibrancy to the world, it's like the perceptual field gets clearer, but it also feels more fluid and transparent. And I think that's why some of these traditional texts refer to it being, you know, more appearing more like a dream or ephemeral. But it's not that it's like a dream. It's not unreal, but it does become, it's almost, it lights up or becomes illuminated and more vibrant as the body does as well. So, yeah, very interesting, this verticality, this this sense of alignment that happens.
I want to address the courage I think that it requires to go through this process. And, you know, that was very apparent with a lot of the stories you shared of the people that you worked with in your practice. And no more, I think, highlighted than the really inspirational story of meeting your first wife, because, yeah, that was phenomenal. And presumably at quite a young age. And I wanted to, get that in your words, because that was a real an amazing story and an amazing sort of following of faith and the heart.
Well, yeah, I had met my first wife, Linda, let's see, it was 1981, so I was 31 years old. And there was just a you know, we met at a workshop on intuition, of all things. And she was a highly intuitive person. She actually had a master's degree in counseling and worked as an intuitive counselor. I was in my in my doctoral program at the time, and so working on my dissertation, and took this workshop where we met. And she felt an immediate connection with me, and we partnered off, and there was just a profound and immediate resonance, you know, on all levels. And on my, I think on my first date, I asked her to marry me, which is very
not the most ordinary behavior.
No, I mean, totally atypical for me at the time. I was very cautious, you know, and I would say somewhat reserved. And so I was just like, you know, really taken by something much more profound. And then, you know, in our next date, she said, well, there's some things I need to tell you. You know, I actually have a life-threatening illness. And you know, my doctors have said I probably have 5 years to live and I have very little money. And, you know, I'm deeply touched by your love and your proposal. But, you know, you're free to withdraw it. You didn't know my condition. And then I was in a dilemma. You know, it's like, oh, my goodness, you know, there's such a yes here. And yet my you know, rational mind was like this, I'm walking into a nightmare because I, you know, I was an impoverished graduate student. And so, you know, I wrestled with it, but actually not for long. It was interesting. I just trusted. It felt like it was the right move. And so, yeah, she almost, she had a episode. She had a heart defect that she was born with and that wasn't repaired when she was little. So she had pulmonary hypertension and diabetes and arteriosclerosis and a lot of really deep systemic problems. And she almost died before we got married. She was hospitalized and they ran what's called in the States Code Blue, you know, which is when someone is close to death, and resuscitated her. But a few months later, we got married, and it was just you know, such a transformative and beautiful relationship. And you know, we enjoyed almost 7 years together, or a little more. And you know, it was difficult and very challenging. The hardest thing I've ever gone through, you know, is to love someone deeply and be unable to. You know, and watch them suffer and be unable to do anything or very little about it. That was the hardest part. So, you know, it was a difficult experience, certainly a very challenging one, but one I have absolutely no regrets and enormous gratitude for, because it was so profoundly transformative. And it was very interesting after Linda passed away for me to see ways that I was using that relationship to try to feel a sense of emptiness and lack in myself in subtle ways. I mean, it was a very authentic and deep and transformative relationship, but there were aspects of psychological merging. And so there was a very important kind of debriefing internally and facing of how I had used that relationship in a way to not face certain things in myself. So, you know, the work continues. You suggested earlier, David, that this is a lifelong process of inquiry, and I totally agree with that. This is an open-ended process of discovery and refinement, and the courage really comes from the love of truth. You know, if we really want to know what's true, if we're really devoted, you know, and devoted is a word I choose quite meaningfully. If we're really devoted to reality, to the truth of our being, then that will fuel and inspire this revelatory inquiry process.
Reminds me of that Henry David Thoreau quote: "Don't give me fame, success, or money; just give me the truth."
Beautiful.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you can learn more about our guest at innertruth.org/touch. You can also reach John directly at listeningfromsilence.com. You've been listening to the Inner Truth podcast with me, David Newell. To keep us in your journey, you can subscribe on iTunes via the podcast app or at innertruth.org/iTunes. You can do the same with Android via the Google Play Store or at innertruth.org/play. Until next time.